Hello, Catherine here. If you're listening to my podcast because you're a fan of wintering, the good news is that my new book, Enchantment, is available now. It's a book about how we can find a way to reconnect with a world that's sometimes hard to live in and even to find magic there. It's available in all good bookshops and please support your local indie if you can. For more information, you can go to catherine-may.com/enchantment. Happy reading.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes. Nice
dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to the Wintering Sessions with me, Catherine May. Each week I talk to a writer about the wintering periods in their own life, where they felt isolated, rejected, forced into the role of outsider, or like they've fallen through the cracks. Today I'm delighted to speak to Catherine Cho, literary agent and author of the memoir Inferno, a vivid and absolutely extraordinary account of her postpartum psychosis after the birth of her son, Cato. Welcome, Catherine.
Thanks for having me, Catherine.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. I love the way that lockdown is letting us connect up online rather than having to organise really difficult meetings and things like that.
Yeah.
It just makes this whole thing possible somehow.
I know.
So I read your amazing book, last year, and I was just immediately struck by how extraordinary it was. I felt like it took me to a place that I didn't understand at all and didn't really even know existed, I suppose, if I'm completely honest. Can you tell us a little bit about the time that Inferno covers?
Yeah, so Inferno takes place during the 2 weeks that I was sectioned in a psychiatric unit in the US, mm-hmm. Which happened a few months after the birth of my son. It's about I had postpartum psychosis, I guess that's important to say. So I had experienced a complete sort of break from reality. Mm. And in that, I start in the ward and it kind of flashes back to events earlier in my life and then also to the thing that led up to psychosis. And it's more of an examination of why the psychosis might have happened.
Yeah, and it does. It almost feels like we land with you in the ward, like you've come to there from nowhere, because you had quite a blank, didn't you, when you first kind of came back into your own mind?
Yes, it's amazing in a way in that I woke up with that sensation of really not knowing who I was and everything. It was such a strange kind of, as you say, blankness, and everything kind of came back in stages, and it was really disorienting and a bit hard to kind of come to terms with. Yeah.
It must have been completely terrifying. And I reading it, I felt terrified on your behalf. I couldn't imagine what it must be like to really lose that sense of identity, I suppose. To be in such an alien environment. You were visiting family in America and traveling, weren't you?
Yes. So, which I guess in retrospect was a very sort of naive decision, but I wanted to use our shared parental leave to do a cross-country tour of the U.S. Wow. So we went to 5 different cities, and we started when my son was 2 months old. We went from California to Virginia, finally to New Jersey. And, you know, I guess that sort of sleeplessness and a lot of the sort of cultural pressures that I was facing. So my family and my in-laws are both Korean. And in Korean culture, you really don't travel with a newborn baby. Actually, you're meant to stay home and stay put
for 100 kind of in days. Confinement
for 21 days. But 100 days of, yes, being very careful. Right. And they thought that we were being incredibly reckless. And I think that sort of combination of factors and being away from home kind of was a perfect storm for that situation.
Yeah. It really made me think about those early days of having a baby when you're not really sure what your restrictions and allowances are yet. You haven't really got the hang of how your life has changed. And I think it's really easy at that point to push yourself too far without knowing it's too far. Just stuff that would have been great in your previous life is suddenly really difficult and fraught and full of tension, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I think especially nowadays, there's this expectation that, you know, you don't want to admit that life has really changed.
Mm.
But actually, it's, you know, a very vulnerable time. And I remember, you know, giving birth and I was in the hospital for about a week in recovery. But afterwards, I was like, you know, I'm going to do this and do that. And I remember, you know, I remember going to my office to like introduce the baby to friends and to my colleagues. And thinking about it now, it's just like, I didn't have anything to prove, but I guess I wanted to show that I still could do all the things I wanted to do when actually maybe I couldn't.
I remember taking my son out to a local cafe and the cafe owner coming and kind of cooing about him and sort of, oh, he's gorgeous, but why are you outside? And I kind of thought, well, because I just want to be a person again. I don't know. It's just such a bizarre, unsettling time. And I really related to your description of your family kind of and your husband's family almost compulsively telling you about stuff that could go wrong with babies. I remember my mother doing the same thing. And it really gets inside your head, doesn't it? This kind of new fear that you didn't even know you ought to have before.
It's funny because I think it's a compulsion that people, it's a compulsion that people have that, you know, they want to kind of warn you. And as they warn you, they want to emphasize the warning with a story, which isn't necessary, you know, something to kind of illustrate their point. And I guess as a mother, I mean, even from when you're pregnant, you feel this new sense of anxiety and uncertainty, and just hearing stories about all the things that can go wrong, I think, you know, isn't really the most helpful thing.
it just brought to mind me standing in the kitchen holding my son and my mum kind of blurting this story she'd heard about somebody who threw a baby out of a window. And I remember just staring at her and clinging on to him like and saying, why are you telling me this right now? And I don't think she really knew either. I think it just brought it into her mind, and people tell you all sorts of terrible things, and it's a really tricky time to navigate, and you're managing other people's feelings as well as your own, and it's really difficult. It's no surprise that more of us don't suffer.
I mean, that was kind of my conclusion from it.
Yeah,
from the experience.
You did,
like,
the
oh,
really logical,
you know,
thing.
Just go crazy.
So I mean, you know, you laugh as they go crazy, but I think what came first for you was a kind of sense of paranoia. Is that right? A sense of being observed?
Yes, there was a building sense of paranoia, which I think was exacerbated by being in the U.S. for whatever reason. My in-laws always had nest cams in the house and on. So I felt like I was being surveilled. And actually, you know, I was in many ways. And that just, I reached this new level of just an awareness that I was being watched. And I thought that what people were saying weren't necessarily what they meant, or that they were trying to communicate in a secret way. But I suppose the trigger for me was actually my father-in-law telling me a story, kind of a similar story of what your mother told you, which was he told me about someone he knew who had shaken her baby, and then the baby went blind. And he was telling me this as a warning because he felt that I was, you know, depressed maybe, or just not taking care of myself.
Right.
And in that moment, I just remember this new sense of fear and kind of uncertainty. And when I went to go pick up my son, his face had changed. Mm. And that was when kind of everything very quickly sort of fell apart.
Yeah. And so this from the outside, extraordinary process began to happen whereby reality changed around you. To me as a reader who, you know, hasn't experienced what you've been through, felt psychedelic. I mean, such a complete other reality began to unfold for you.
It was a whole other kind of dimension. I mean, I suppose, you know, when I think about it now, I do think it must be like being on psychedelics, in that your subconscious is processing things the same time as you're processing, you know, life in real time. So you automatically lose any sense of time as time is passing. And your brain anything triggers a memory, it triggers a moment, it triggers something in your imagination. So you can no longer be sure what is actually real and what is not real.
Yeah, and so that really began to kick off for you when you looked at your son and saw him with demon eyes, as you described them, kind of red eyes. Yeah, and so what unfolded after that? Can you describe it, if you don't mind?
No, yes, of course. His eyes looked like devil's eyes to me, and in that moment I knew something was really wrong, but I didn't know what was wrong. And it quickly devolved into, I asked my husband to take me out of my in-laws' house and into a hotel, which he did. Which I'm very grateful for. He didn't ask any questions. He just took us.
Yeah.
And in the hotel, I thought that we were in a simulation, that we were stuck in this hotel room, that we couldn't leave. And so I started experiencing time kind of in a multiplied way. And I thought that my son had died. And, you know, at one point I thought I was hearing the voice of God telling me that, you know, that I was in hell and that I was Beatrice, and that my husband was Dante, and that we were destined to walk the circles of hell, I suppose. And yeah, it just really escalated from there, in that ultimately when my husband realized that I really wasn't well, he took me to the emergency room, and then from there it just becomes a complete sort of psychotic break, where I'm not tied to reality at all.
And you described all these kind of jungle animals kind of prowling the ER, this kind of sense that I mean, it's otherworldly, isn't it? And I'm kind of blown away by what our minds can do under intense pressure, which is what was happening to you. You were under unbearable pressure.
Yes, it is. It is frightening how the mind, you realize kind of how, in a way, it can be a prison, in that you're just so at the mercy of what your mind is experiencing or thinking that it's experiencing.
And what it says to me is that our sense of reality is so subjective, and
yes, definitely,
it's really not stable in the way that we think it is, because that can all unfold for us. How do you feel looking back on it now? I mean, it's amazing to talk to you because you report it in, you know, in almost a sort of detached, calm, rational way.
Oh, thanks.
And I think that's, I'm so impressed by that. You seem to have this perspective on it that is really clear-eyed.
Thank you. I guess I had a lot of time to process it. So the psychosis, psychotic episode itself lasted, I think, around 5 days, from what I understand. And then after that, I was in a psychiatric unit, where I was kind of trying to piece everything together. And then I had, when I came back to London, I fell into a very deep depression, which is typical for people who've experienced psychosis. And I think it was during that time that I really thought about it and considered it. And I, you know, I didn't want to feel afraid of the experience, which is why I think I thought about it so much. I wanted to understand and kind of trace the reasons for why it happened, kind of what it meant maybe, and, you know, remember as much of it as I could, just because it was terrifying, because I genuinely believed that I was in a computer simulation and that my entire life to that point was, you know, had been just a simulation or an experience of hell, which is terrifying. But I think in trying to understand it, that in a way gives you a bit of control over the narrative and a bit of understanding about it as well.
And presumably writing about it helps quite a lot too, I guess.
Yes, definitely. So I kept a journal throughout the experience, even during psychosis, actually, which it's unreadable because it doesn't make any sense. But during the depression, I kept a journal. And I think writing about it really helped me remember it and then process it. And then by the time I decided, you know, actually, I want to write a book about it, I felt that I'd processed it enough to have a certain distance from the experience.
Well, I'm really glad you did write a book about it because I was completely enchanted by it. I would really love to talk about your time in the mental health unit, or secure unit, as you say, in the American hospital. Because that sounded like quite a tricky social environment to navigate. Would that be fair to say?
Yes, it was. So I guess one complication of the experience, which anytime I mention it to someone who's not American, they immediately understand, is I didn't have health insurance.
Right.
I had traveler's insurance, which is a, you know, completely different thing. And for my husband, a lot of the experience was actually trying to navigate the insurance. So because of that, I was put into, well, they don't have mother-baby units in the U.S., which they have here in the U.K. So I was put in a general facility, and the facility I was put in was primarily for people who on Medicaid, Medicare. So there were quite a few veterans. There were people who were homeless, people who, you know, to be frank, I was extremely privileged compared to the majority of the people in the ward. And the majority of the people are returners. So they're constantly in the ward, then they're released, and then they come back again. So it's very much a revolving door. So it's a very strange environment to be in because there are set rules that are unspoken, and obviously everybody's kind of going through their own thing and going through their own experience. And it feels very much, you know, I guess categorized by race as well, I think is, you know, a very uniquely kind of American experience. But yes, it was, you know, I think when you don't really know for sure who you are, the easiest way to identify someone else or yourself is just by what they look like, by what you see. So for example, for me, I had a lot of trouble seeing faces, but I could see the color of their skin, and I'm sure it was the same for them. So everybody kind of self-segregated by race, and, you know, there was very much kind of a hierarchy of who kind of knew what was going on and the, you know, the people who didn't know, and everybody was just desperate to leave. And I think because there aren't the resources there, nobody professional, whether it's a doctor or any of the workers, would really communicate with the patients. So you really felt like you were just kind of existing in this very strange place and not really knowing what's going to happen or what, you know, when you will leave.
It sounds a lot like a prison environment. I mean, just in terms of the fact that you're quite dehumanized, your own clothes are taken away from you, your freedom isn't really your own because you're sectioned. And there's that sense of the kind of long-termers or the people who kind of understand the system.
Yes, I mean, that's how at least my only point of reference was, I think I mentioned in the book, was, you know, the show Orange is the New Black, which is, you know, embarrassing and just shows how, you know, little I know about things. But yeah, it is true. It does feel like that. And then everything kind of there's a very strict schedule. There were incidents of violence, so the police would be called and come and take people away. And yeah, it was just a very strange environment.
It doesn't sound therapeutic.
No, I think, you know,
I mean, that's an understatement, I think, maybe.
It's the opposite. I mean, I remember one thing that really shocked me was they had a television on all the time. And the shows they would watch were like really violent police, right. You know, shows. And I just remember sitting there like watching some version of Law and Order or Criminal Intent and just hearing like guns go off and everybody just kind of is like jolted from the seat. Yeah. And I just feel like, you know, that's not really the right thing to be playing on a television.
No.
Around people who are, you know, experiencing mental illness.
And quite heavy use of medication as well, I think, too, which must make it quite hard to kind of reorient yourself in reality, if that's not a weird way of saying it.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, at least I know for me, my treatment was just medication, and I was given one of the strongest antipsychotics, a first-generation drug, to kind of stop what was going on. And it's just being on that level of medication is a very disorienting experience as well.
I should think so. I mean, I remember being put on very strong old school kind of antidepressants when I was a teenager, and just I'll never forget the feeling of the weight of them in my system. Mm-hmm. They felt like lead in my veins, and I've always refused antidepressants since, which is probably not always wise, but I hear people talk about, you know, having a really great experience with antidepressants now, and I just think, wow, my first experience was so heavy and dreadful that I can't imagine ever going back to them. And I should imagine that your regime was even more extensive. I found it quite frightening. I found it quite sort of, I don't know, terrifying to feel this thing taking control of you, I suppose.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think because you're so aware suddenly of, you know, your body and your mind, and, you know, for me, it affected my eyesight, which I thought was the most difficult because I couldn't read anything. And, right. You know, for me, that was just so disorienting. And, you know, you're not really sure as well, at least with the antipsychotic, I wasn't sure that I was feeling anything either. And that's just very disorienting to me. Mm. Not be sure of what your emotions are. Very strange.
Yeah. Were you desperate to get out, or did it nevertheless feel like a kind of environment that was letting you reset?
Oh, no, I was desperate to leave. Mm. I was desperate to leave, and I didn't understand how I could leave. And a lot of the time I was just trying to figure out how I could leave. And so it was actually, to be honest, my husband, he didn't know. So I remember just asking him, and, you know, he was trying to figure out if I was well enough to leave. And obviously the doctors had their own set of criteria. And I just remember feeling just desperate to prove that, you know, I'm sane enough to leave, which I think, you know, you can laugh about it now. It's like, how do you act sane in a way that is sane?
The harder you try,
that. Exactly. You're like, I probably don't seem sane.
It's literal catch 22, isn't it? It's,
you know, it really is.
Yeah. I don't know what you do to look sane. You probably don't try and demonstrate it in the first place.
Yeah.
So as part of your kind of unraveling process of the kind of forces and situations that led you to that place, you talked about your time with a previous boyfriend where things really collapsed for you and sounded absolutely terrifying. Would you mind talking a little bit about that as well? Because I found that a really startling part of the book that I wasn't expecting to come into the story, really.
Yes, no, of course. My first very serious relationship was with a guy who lived in Hong Kong. It was after university, and I ended up moving to Hong Kong with him. I guess I was very naive. What I didn't realize was that actually he was a very violent and unstable person. Mm. And I guess throughout the relationship, you know, I was more and more in his control, I suppose, just because I was living in his country and with his family. And he was extremely violent and often for no discernible reason.
Right.
And it took me a really long time to realize that it wasn't my fault, and that actually he wasn't going to change. Because I think, you know, I thought maybe, you know, our relationship was complicated, or that I was a difficult girlfriend, and, you know.
Yeah, no one's difficult enough
to bring that about. Differently. Exactly. And I just didn't realize. And once I did realize, it was like a spell had been broken, and I just left without kind of any possessions. But there were many instances where I genuinely thought he might, you know, just kill me.
That's absolutely
and
terrifying.
It is terrifying. And I think especially that sense of not knowing what's going to happen next, you know, or that you're facing, you know, something really terrible. I think, you know, it's really, you know, this disorienting experience. And for me, I suppose I thought I had, you know, processed it and gotten over it. But one of the reasons I included it in the book is that in the psychosis, he kind of came up a lot, kind of in this, you know, whether it was I thought that he was standing outside my door, or, you know, I thought I was, you know, his mother, you know, there was just, he kind of recurred. And I suppose I wanted to show how that there are these kind of echoes in your past that can kind of come up again when you least expect it.
Yeah, the way that trauma just follows you through your life and it's very hard to shed, and under a moment of extreme duress, it feels to me like you joined a lot of dots somehow, and that was catastrophic for you, but it was almost inescapable. Because you also talked about the kind of echoes of your family's, you know, migration away from Korea as well, you know, that sense of escaping that you must have related really strongly to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So when you get back to the UK, you finally got out. They finally let you out. And you spent some time kind of recovering in a hotel room. And you had to make friends with your baby son all over again, I guess. You'd had a long time apart by then.
Yes. So, and I think this is a really common experience for women who've experienced postpartum psychosis, particularly for those who are separated from their babies. So I had spent 2 weeks away from my son, but then by the time we were reintroduced, you know, I kind of thought we would go back to the way we were. But actually, his presence, you know, it was painful physically for me to even touch him. And that was, you know, a really surprising and kind of shocking emotion to feel. And, you know, I had to force myself to kind of, you know, even hold him for longer than a minute or two. And very much a lot of my recovery was focused on trying to rebuild a bond with my son. And I think, you know, there's a lot of shame around that and a lot of, you know, guilt over that as well. And kind of, it's so strange because you don't understand how, you know, a bond like that can be severed, really. But it can be. And I think, you know, when I think about it, I think maybe it's an act of preservation. You know, if a mother is unwell, then maybe part of her is trying to protect her child by sending them away.
And
kind of the most exactly.
Yeah, and protecting yourself too. I was going to say, you know, because the kind of extremity and the absoluteness of maternal love it's just not something you can do 50% of, is it? It's so full on, and I think that initial bond is a bit of a myth, actually. I don't think it's just you that kind of lost a bit of that bond when you had time in hospital. I think it grows, and we don't talk about it as something that grows. We talk about something that lands on us like a divine revelation. And the more women I talk to about those early months, the more of them tell me that wasn't really how it was for them anyway, and that it's maybe a little bit of a heavy expectation on us that many of us feel that we didn't get right first off. and that's mm-hmm. that actually is maternal love. Maybe it is a bit more slow and steady than we are led to believe.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I mean, I do remember, you know, reading about birth experiences and people saying that the moment that their child was placed in their arms, they just felt
tired.
You know, yeah, I know, I felt tired. Yeah, and I just didn't feel that way. And, you know, I was just like, oh, okay. Well, you know, so, because you are strangers, you know, you haven't met this person yet. And at that moment, they're more of an idea than they are a person. You know, they're just kind of this thing that needs sustenance and care. They don't. Yeah, so.
But they're quite frightening at first, I think. Particularly the first one, you know, they're a monumental challenge at a moment when you feel absolutely broken, or maybe that was just me. And I just remember this sense of unreality, actually, when they first put my son in my arms, and it was like, oh God, I thought you were a concept. I didn't think you were an actual thing, and here you are, and oh my God, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the one thing about the psychosis also, is that in a way it's, you know, I've heard that in some cultures it's expected that you feel this dissociation from yourself when you first become a mother.
Wow.
And I think that's not really talked about as much.
Yeah.
That, you know, your mind has to kind of understand this new identity, this new reality. It's a shift.
It makes a load of sense. And I think I end up writing about this and saying it over and over again, but we've tried so hard not to listen to mothers' experiences at these moments in their life and to tell them what their experience should be, that loads of different ways of encountering that moment and that season are coming out now. And it's so important. It's just, I think that's why your account is so important. We've got to hear it. To kind of round up your story, you returned to the UK, and it sounds like you got really excellent care once you got back home again.
I did, yes. Really, you know, I know the book isn't really the kind of book that talks about the differences of the US and the UK medical system.
Yeah, sure.
But it could have been. Yeah. It was night and day. We came back, and I was immediately referred to a perinatal team, and I was assigned to a psychiatrist who met with me, and, you know, she really listened, and she really considered the next steps, because at least in the U.S., when I was released from the ward, the only thing they gave us was a prescription. They didn't give us any instruction.
Wow.
About my care. They didn't, you know, there was no direction, and so really it was up to my husband to kind of come up with what to do next.
A care plan.
A care plan. He came up with the care plan, which to me, now that I realize it, you know, that's just a bit ridiculous.
Yeah.
So I was with the perinatal team, and they knew that, you know, I would most likely experience depression. I didn't know that. I felt fine. So it came as a complete shock to me when, I think it was around 2 or 3 weeks after returning to London, that the depression just came.
Yeah.
It's
almost like a kind of bounce downwards, a sort of equal and opposite reaction to the extreme overstimulation of psychosis, I gather.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of inevitable. But you've gradually got better and, you know, got now a really intense bond with your son.
Yes, I mean, you know, I'm very fortunate in that, you know, it took, you know, time, but for me, the depression was around, you know, 2-3 months, and then, which, you know, seemed unending at the time, but, you know, it did end. And then I was on medication for, you know, basically a year, and then throughout that time, I was just building the bond with my son and kind of waiting to feel, you know, like we had a bond. Mm. And I can, you know, I can say now that we definitely do. I mean, he's 2.5 now, so it has taken time. But I thought I had a bond with him, you know, from the early days. But actually, now that I think back on it, I was still pretty distant. And so it came about very gradually.
Mm.
And it was something that we had to build. I had to build this, a very conscientious effort.
Yeah. I think it just takes a bit longer for some of us, you know. And I love the way you talk about the whole experience, you know, right from the start, right to the, you know, that long process of bonding without any shame. I think it's so important that we are able to do that and we're able to let each other do that without any judgment. It's just massively refreshing. And I so admire it.
Thank you. No, I think that's really important. And, you know, that was one of my primary motivators, you know, in terms of writing the book, is that there is so much stigma and shame, especially around postpartum psychosis. But, you know, I think it would be helpful. I think once people have empathy and kind of understand the reasoning, then, you know, that shame should be erased. And a lot of the shame, and I think guilt, is, you know, self-imposed, but also I think society in general is just very judgmental about anything in terms of motherhood. And it's so unnecessary and I think really harmful, actually, to women.
Oh, I really think it is. And I think every single woman I know who's had a child trails around with some sense of shame about something. It's like we're all just perpetually ashamed and we never have the space to kind of say, oh, do you know what? I'm doing okay. I'm not going to win any awards, but I always see that kind of Tesco Mother of the Year thing come past and think, whoa, lady, I don't know how you do that. But we're doing okay, you know, and we've got nothing to be ashamed of.
Yeah, definitely. Everyone's just trying to survive. I think that was my conclusion from the end of this experience is, you know, everyone is just trying to survive. I really cannot judge. And I shouldn't judge. Yeah.
So how would you approach the whole process? I don't know if you ever want to have another child again. It's none of my business to ask, but would you have any thoughts or feelings about how you'd approach it differently? What have you learned for any other time around with this kind of experience?
Yes. Well, I do want another child, you know, if we're able to have one. It is a bit daunting because the statistics for women who've had postpartum psychosis, it's 50%.
Wow.
That it will happen again. You know, which when you hear that, when my husband heard that, he was like, we're not having another child. But for me, I was like, no, I think it'll be fine.
I'll go in for another round with all of that. So.
But I think, you know, well, for one thing, I feel much more confident in that hearing those sort of stories and feeling that sort of uncertainty, I wouldn't feel that way again. I would have kind of the strength to know that I'm actually doing the right thing, that I'm not endangering my son. And I think I wouldn't be so susceptible to criticism or to warning. I wouldn't travel.
Right, yeah.
Especially not to 5 different cities and 5 different places. Mm. You know, that's just a bit silly. But yeah, I think the main thing also is I would just take care of myself, which is, you know, anytime someone I know tells me that they're expecting a child, you know, I don't give advice, but the one thing I do say is just take some time for yourself and take care of yourself, because I think the focus so much is on taking care of a child that often, you know, it was the reason we got travelers insurance. I got it because of, you know, my son. Yeah. I didn't realize I would be the one using it. So yeah, I think that sort of mentality is just something to bear in mind.
And it is something that we lose so often in so many different parts of our life that we don't think we should prioritize our own needs. And the problem is that we push ourselves too far so often. I know I've done that a whole range of different ways in my life. And I think it is the greatest thing you'll ever learn to really take care of yourself alongside all the other things. So you are, as well as a writer, a literary agent, a busy literary agent. I'm very impressed that you managed to write a book amongst all the other things you do. It seems to take up a lot more of my headspace than that. So that's very admirable. Are you planning any more books, or is this a kind of one-off thing that you wanted to express?
Well, Yeah, I think the only reason I was able to write it was I was still on maternity leave. I think that's why it's actually very, you know, I hadn't really thought about writing as a literary agent just because you have so many voices in your head as a literary agent. You know, you're constantly reading new material and, reading submissions and reading your own clients' work. So I think I was only able to really do that because I had the space to myself.
Yeah.
Well, after the experience, I have thought, you know, it would be lovely to write more things, but I just don't know what else I would write about. My editor asked me, she was like, do you have other books in mind? And I really don't. So maybe, you know, I don't have that creative mind. I don't know.
Well, you clearly do, but I think some people have like bigger gaps between books than others, don't they? I think, oh, well, I mean, you see this, you see loads of different examples, many more than I do, but it's, how did it, has it changed your attitude to the writers in your care writing a book yourself? Did it reveal stuff that you didn't know before?
Oh, I mean, definitely. I hadn't expected it to, but I realized just how vulnerable it is to write something and then share it with someone.
You know what we go through now.
Exactly. It was terrifying, to send something to my agent and wait for her to tell me what she thought about it. And, you know, you realize how vulnerable that whole process is. And I remember when she was starting to submit to editors, it was
that's the worst.
The worst experience.
It
just
sucks
waiting.
So much. It really does.
Yeah, there's really nothing to kind of, you're just waiting. And so I think one thing it's really taught me is a whole level of empathy for writers and kind of what they're going through. And I think sometimes, you know, as agents, you just see so many writers and manuscripts, you can kind of forget that behind every manuscript, there's years or months, you know, there's someone's life behind that.
There's a quaking so, human being.
Yeah. it's a good reminder.
Yeah. I really, really do sincerely believe that memoirists in particular need a support group, you know, that we can go to once a week and just talk about the trauma of everyone being all up in our business. And I still feel that compulsion to share more. Like, I don't know why I do it, but it's what I do. Well, it has been absolutely amazing to talk to you. I have longed to be able to ask you about your book for a very, very long time now, because I really just felt like it opened a doorway to another world, and I admire it so much. So thank you so much for talking to me tonight, and wish you all the best with your son and your future plans, which sound very exciting.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Catherine.
Thank you.
And that's all for this week's show. Thank you so much to Catherine Cho for her incredible wisdom and insight. If you enjoyed today's show, please subscribe and give us a star rating. It really helps. And join us next week to meet a writer who found winter a comfort when she was making a huge change in her life. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.